Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I'll be coming to you from Portugal for the next 6 weeks, so yeah. Suck it. I'm just kidding. To those checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down and listen. Today's podcast is really a fascinating guy, Alan Fadden. Alan is an author, consultant, corporate trainer, and he came from the ad agency or ad world, owned his own company, sold it, started working for Foot, Cone, and Belden, left, did stand-up comedy, and wrote parody comical songs. He just has a world of randomness, but it's just fascinating. And what's really most interesting about Alan is his upbringing with his mother and father passing away young, when he was young, and the abusiveness that went on. And he explains it better than I can. But have a listen to that. It's a really heartbreaking story. The other thing is that this interview was done over two different time periods. I forgot to hit record the first time we sat down, so I missed his childhood. And so, came back on and we recorded that. So you're going to kind of pick that up halfway through. But all in all, fantastic interview. And Alan is an open, honest, funny, witty man. So, all right. Thanks to all my content partners, specifically C-Suite Radio. And as always, leave a review on iTunes. All right. Have a nice week, everyone. See you. Well, Alan Fadden, this is a take two for us for the intro section, since my intellectual capacity when we talked last time, I was so enamored of you, I forgot to hit record. So this time you were gracious enough to come back again and sit down with me and just kind of tell me about where you're from, you know, your early years.
Yes.
Sorry, well, so that wasn't really a question in that at all, by the way. So Alan, where are you from?
I'm from Des Moines, Iowa.
Hmm. And so Des Moines, Iowa, that's the capital, right?
It's the capital of Iowa, and it is such a boring place innately that the people became way more interesting because there was nothing to do. So everybody had to make up things, and it was a great place to be a kid.
So as a kid, what did you get into? What kind of fun did you do?
Oh boy! Well, as an early kid, imagination was everything, because imagination is a great way to escape from reality if you don't like your reality. So we'd make up our own reality as kids and play games, and then it got into sports, and then into juvenile delinquency. I think I had every street sign from Des Moines, Iowa in my bedroom. We had gone out purposefully and knocked them down. They're the old kind that were hand-painted and nailed to telephone poles.
Oh, yeah.
Wooden street signs and bus stop signs, and oh, my God.
So what was the reason?
Come into my bedroom.
Like, what was the reason for all that?
I have no idea. Just self-expression, I think. Part of it was rebellion. Part of it was showing whatever limited power and creativity one could at that age, where you're, you know, pretty much stomped on. And all of that.
So you had mentioned earlier, like, your imagination. So when I was a kid, you know, I was the youngest by five, and no one really gave a shit about me. So my parents were exhausted all the time from work. Both overweight, not healthy, so, and a bit old school with the parenting, where kids are to be there but not necessarily entertained. And so I would play by myself for just hours on end with cars, Matchbox cars. I remember it so vividly.
Oh, yeah.
And so for you, you said you escaped reality. What reality were you trying to escape?
Yeah. Well, there, just about everything. My father was from Vienna. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I learned in later life, I had read this book by Alice Miller, I think her name was, and it was something like The Secret of the Gifted Child. And basically, I got one thing out of that book, and it said, she said, the Austrian parenting model was such that because Hitler was from Austria, if he would have had children, then there would have been no Holocaust because he would have taken everything out on his children. So, and I said, oh, that explains my father.
So give me an example of the taking out. Like, you know, when I was talking to Doug Krug last night, he was talking about his upbringing, and it was more of an emotional abuse versus the physical abuse.
Oh, yeah. Well, my father what would you say? He was a Renaissance man of abuse. He was into every kind of abuse he could think of. He was the Leonardo da Vinci of abuse.
All right. How do you mean by that?
Well, emotional, intellectual, physical threats, even a little sexual abuse. I mean, the guy was he had it all, and I was a completely terrorized kid. When I went to kindergarten, now this is funny because I'm a professional speaker and I get paid for standing up in front of audiences doing silly things. And at the time, I was in kindergarten, and the teacher called on me. And whenever I'd get called on, I'd turn red as a beet, and my eyes would water. And everybody thought I was crying, but it's just I was so embarrassed that tears would well up in my face, and I didn't want anybody to look at me. So that's pretty much the way I became socialized out of that family.
So you talked about a lot of this abuse. Where was your mom in all this?
She was. She must have had a little switch. I think she, in those days, you know, you didn't push buttons to do things. You usually turned knobs. And I think she had a knob on the right side of her head. She just click and she'd turn it off. And then she'd pretty much go zombie. That would be it. She, you know, in other words, she wasn't there.
Did he do the same thing to her?
Oh, yeah. And I really didn't realize that. I didn't have much memory of that. But I actually did some age regression stuff, some hypnosis and things like that. And I got my memories back. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have even thought about that or believed it, except my sister, who was my only other sibling, decided to do the same thing. And she had no memory either. Neither one of us had any memory of anything like before age 5. And I think you're cognitive when you're 3. She did the same thing. We didn't tell each other what we actually experienced, but we played our own tapes back to each other. And we weren't prompted. And it was like camera 1 and camera 2.
Wow.
It was eerie.
And yeah, I have to wonder with your mom, like that switch was basically because she felt powerless against your dad. And
oh, yeah.
All she could do is just turn herself off.
Yep, she just went. She actually in the hypnosis scene, she actually came down to the basement and caught him, and then just got a blank look on her face, turned around, and went back up the stairs.
What do you mean caught him?
Caught him physically abusing me. He was I was very small, and he was banging me around, and he had this bin of old wood, and he was smashing me around and not yelling at me. And she just kind of turned and walked up the stairs, and that was it.
It was almost like self-preservation. What's fascinating to me about that, though, is like usually mother's instinct is to kind of protect their kids. Where your mom kind of went the other way. Was she abused as a child herself? Do you know? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I would be surprised if she wasn't, just because, you know, I mean, I did a lot of study after that on the family dynamic and everything. I mean, she died when I was 13. My father died when I was 8. I went to live with my aunt and my druncle, and they had the same family dynamic. I mean, it's just all kinds of, it was real obvious, in other words, that it was, that she had it done to her. And I think
she had a history, you know, right?
Yeah, and he probably had it done to him. You know, people pass it on.
You know,
the only thing I'm proud of is I broke that cycle with Mike.
Which
kids.
Is huge, right? And we'll quickly talk about that, because I can't remember where the recording started, finished last time. I had a neighbor kid of mine whose dad had wooden paddles, but the wooden paddles had different size holes depending on the mistake he made.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of thought that goes into that one.
Yeah, well, and the thing I would hear in our family is that when my father would spank us, each one of them was very measured and very calculated. So it's kind of the same thing.
Mm.
Yes.
I think you know, my dad, he spanked. That was his big thing. Occasional slap in the face if you were disrespectful, or a poke in the chest, which isn't, you know, it hurt. But in hindsight, it could have been a hell of a lot worse. But I remember the spanking was almost always with a belt, almost always on your bare ass. And if it wasn't with a belt, it was with his hand on your bare ass. So like,
oh, Jesus,
was, you know, and this is, I mean, I think the oldest I was when it happened, I want to say seventh grade, because I got caught cheating on a spelling test. I had a really good system going and I got nabbed. And so I remember he spanked me, and afterwards it didn't have the same impact as when you're like five or six, right? I'm 13. And I just thought to myself, what's the point of that? You know, your disappointment and your dissatisfaction of my behavior and your embarrassment of me probably would have been enough in a conversation. So I'm not sure. So anyhow, it's just as you get older, you can kind of disassociate those two.
Oh yeah. And the big question is, what was in it for him?
Yeah. You know, and here's the thing about my dad I always find fascinating is everyone who knew my dad, you know, my dad passed away when I was 20. Everyone who knew my dad, like universally, he was the nicest, most gentle guy we knew. Right.
Well,
so, and I don't think this was, again, I don't think he spanked me every week or every day. In his mind, he would justify it with whatever, you know, action equals consequence in his mind. And I'm sure that's exactly how he was raised, without a doubt. But my mom said they used to get in fights about it all the time, about disciplining. Like, it was a very common – my mom preferred the verbal one. He just chose the physical one. But it's always – it's interesting dynamic. So anyhow, so, you know, you mentioned something about your mom and dad dying. Your dad at eight. You know, when your dad died at eight and you had that – was that 6 years, I guess, 5 years before your mom passed away – what was the house like without your dad in the picture?
It was it was a dichotomy. It was very much safer on one hand, and then boring and empty on the other hand. I mean, I spent the first 8 years of my life trying to find an escape route, and I owe him for that, because it made me adept creatively, where you know, a very small percentage of the population can do. I know where to go places. I've been there, so I know where to go for ideas. And I'm quick, and it's because I developed these muscles at an early age. Well, now the house is relatively safe, and there's nothing to do, and it's boring, and it's empty. And so there's another, you know, another set of problems. And and my mother really wasn't very socialized, except for her friends. She really never. She had a good business mind, but she was, you know, that in those days, if you were a woman, you were a secretary, or a nurse, or a teacher, and that's it. And so she just sat there and smoked cigarettes and played solitaire and, you know, let herself die of cancer.
So when she passed away, you're 13, what's kind of going through your head at that point?
It's like, wow, now what? Mm-hmm. And we actually had quite a few choices, but the places we would live, and we wanted this. My sister and I both wanted to stay in Des Moines. We had friends by then. I was actually, you know, I was a popular kid because I was really good at knocking down street signs, and so I had friends I wanted to stay, and we had some parents of friends who said, "Come live with us. Finish high school here." And my aunt, who was very domineering, very controlling, her mantra was, "Helen, you'll never amount to anything."
Yeah, it's one of those.
And
as if your self-esteem wasn't already beat up enough.
That's right. Thank you so much. Yeah. And so we wound up moving to Minneapolis to live with my aunt and my druncle. And it was like, wow. And I thought living in an empty house of abuse where my parents were dying wasn't fun. I was wrong about that, because compared to where I am now, that was a lot of fun. I want to go back.
So was it, did you ever figure out why she wanted to have you and your sister live with her? She seemed to hate kids.
Yeah. Because, my mother was saved and scrimped and saved and really, you know, when the kids would wear a new shoe called white bucks at the time, I wanted a pair of white bucks, and I think she'd find a pair of used golf shoes and then pull all the spikes out and make me wear those. You know, if there's anything that you could wear at school that made you a geek, because it was cheap, that's what we would get. So she saved quite a bit of money, and then she put it in trust for us. And my aunt arranged for that trust fund to pay her to have us there. And she had enough to move into a larger house. And then she immediately sent my sister away to college and me away to military school, boarding school. So she had no kids, but she had more income. So
how long did you actually live with her then before you left?
It seemed like an eternity, but it was actually age 13 up till, well, I was gone almost all the time away at school. But when I finished college at about age 22, something like that, then she couldn't understand why I immediately got an apartment the second I got a job.
So in some ways, I mean, you talk about how bad it was there, but in some ways it was a blessing because it took you out of that environment and put you in a slightly more structured environment, but perhaps more healthy. Mm-hmm. No?
No. But it was its own kind of misery. It was I was the only kid in military school who wanted to stay there for holidays. I didn't want to go home. everybody'd leave, and the school'd be empty now. And I'd say, "Geez, I hope they don't remember that I'm here."
It's kind of like Harry Potter in a way, really.
That's a good one.
So you'd have to go home for holidays. So every time you'd go home, basically you're terrorized. And how did you not? How did you not fight? I mean, I'm sure you did, but how did you not basically stand up for yourself at some point in your teenage years, just because of the independence you've gained over the time?
Oh yeah. I would basically rebel. I rebelled against everything. If there was a rule, I would break it. I started smoking at about age 11, and that's so my aunt would find something I liked and try to take it away from me. So she'd try to get me to stop smoking. I learned how to play the guitar. I started playing in bands, and she'd cook up something, you know, "Oh, you left the garage door open. You can't have your guitar for a month," that kind of thing. So I would just rebel. And then, of course, I couldn't have a conversation with her, and so I learned how to lie. Mm-hmm. And so I'd just say, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to go out for a little walk now," and you know, and then I just do whatever I wanted to do. It's the only way I could survive. It was pretty much my conception of what prison would be like.
So you called her husband Drunkle. So do you think he was just drunk to avoid dealing with her?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I took them both to a psychologist once, and he pretty much said that.
You know, wow. Yeah. I said that tongue in cheek, but wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever figure out why she, like, did she ever, I mean, I doubt she did, but like, what was the manifestation of her needing to control everything? Because usually when someone is hyper-controlling, that means they're actually totally out of control internally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and she was. I mean, she was taking, in those days it was called Miltown, I think. It was like mixing booze and antidepressants and then trying to hold it all together. And he was in AA and drinking all the time and gone 5 days a week. You know, that's the only reason I think they held it together. But I think, none of them would talk about their past. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that she had it all done to her.
Isn't it fascinating, though, where people, like, misery loves company? So two people who come from pretty dysfunctional background, because they're dysfunctional, it just seems like easy puzzle piece to fit together.
It certainly does. It's a friend of mine said it's like her knobs fit his holes. You know, it's like those imperfections. And it's, you know, if you're used to all that, it's crazy not to have it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, wow, something's wrong here. Gosh.
Well, I would imagine
some more abuse.
Well, I would imagine. So, I mean, I was going to say that for you. And I know this was for me, and you probably were even more intensified. Like, after you got out in 22, I would imagine, like, you almost felt a void without some sort of chaos in your life. And it was probably really confusing for you. And so sometimes you would create the chaos because that is what was comfortable for you. Did you go through any of that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, after military school, they sent me to the college that they picked for me. And I got there, and there's an old film called Animal House.
Yes.
That's John Belushi. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And it was like, a few years later, 10 years, I don't know, later that came out, and I'm sitting there watching the film, and I said, oh my God, this is my autobiography. And that, so that was, that's how I created it. It's like rebellion of any kind, any place. And, here we go. Let's have as much fun as humanly possible. And, you know, there's the cut a swath, so to speak.
So I was
kicked out of college at the end of my freshman year.
So then what happened after that?
I went to a school that you go to when you get kicked out of your first school. It's called Kendall College in Evanston, Illinois. And the status there was, where'd you get kicked out of? And I said, oh, Gustavus Adolphus College. I never heard of that. But see that guy over there? He got kicked out of Harvard. Oh, my God. So it's like, what school you got kicked out of, did you? That guy got kicked out of MIT twice. Oh, my God.
Nice work, buddy.
We worship you. Yeah, we worship you.
So
we're unworthy.
So have you ever, and I didn't ask you this in our first go around, but I'm just curious. Have you ever, at this point in your life, like how old are you now, Alan?
I am 72.
Wow. You're a spry SOB. Have you ever, looked back and just thought to yourself, how the hell did I get here from where you came from? Like, why was I able to change the cycle?
Oh yeah. Good one. I've done that so much that it's kind of, it's no longer a wonder.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of therapy. I was in so much pain. This all this buried stuff wanted to come out, and I was going to explode if it didn't come out. And you know, drugs wasn't it for me or anything like that. So I just finally said, you know, it was actually at the end of my first marriage where we went to couples therapy, and so the guy kept working on me, and then we started getting all this stuff to come out. And then one day he looked at her and he says, "Now it's your turn." And she says, "Me? What do you mean me? I came here to fix him." So I kept going, and she's still, in the words of Don Henley of the Eagles, the same old girl you used to be.
So today I was writing the chapter on self-awareness, and you know, my wife and I were having this kind of interesting debate, because one of my theories is that you have to go through a crucible to really be able to be self-aware or be more self-aware.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, absolutely. And she was like, well, she's like, I don't really agree with that. So what do you mean? She's like, well, I haven't had any major issues, and I think I'm self-aware. And so we had this basically long debate about what self-aware actually means to her versus me. And I said, you know, in the book, I also write this, and I say, you know, a crucible is a very personal thing, and only you can judge the level and depth of that crucible for you. But for my guess is that the bigger the crucible, the deeper that avalanche is, the higher the peak will be on the other side when you start being self-aware of what's going on. And so I think there's a direct correlation between the depth of the crucible and the height of the self-awareness. But it was this interesting debate. And then we started talking about why people don't do self-awareness as like just in life. Like, how do you not matriculate? Like, I've interviewed people and I've asked them questions who are 70 years old, and I've said, what advice would you give your 25-year-old self? And they would say, nothing really. And I'm like, how do you go through life for 50 plus years and never stop and go like, what would I have done different? No one's life is that perfect. And so so the whole idea of self-awareness to me is really quite interesting.
Oh, yeah. Me too. There's one of the books that kind of changed my life was Be Here Now by Ram Dass, who was originally Dr. Richard Alpert. Herb Alpert? Do you want a breath? No. Richard Alpert, who was a disciple of Timothy Leary into the drug culture at Harvard. And they took LSD, they got to the garden, but they kept having to come back here. And so and Alpert thought there's got to be a better way. He winds up going to India, meditation. You know, now he's a guy with a long beard, looks like R. Crumb's comic character, Mr. Natural, long dress, driving a 38 Buick. And he wrote a book called Be Here Now. One of the concepts he talked about was straightening by fire. I read this book when I was 27 years old, and there was a paradox in there. And that's the only way to have it all is to give it all up. And I couldn't get that, and I couldn't get that, and I couldn't get that. And I was staying home from work, and I stayed home for about a week and contemplated that. And finally, one day I got it, and I laughed for about 2 days straight. And that was amazing. But one of the big things is straightening by fire. If you don't have something that happens to you where it's like, oh, my God, my life is over, this is awful, then nothing's going to happen.
You're going to partake in my new segment. Let's get authentic. So you ready to get authentic? This shouldn't be a problem for you.
So I've been faking it this whole time. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Son of a bitch. All right.
Yes.
Question one. How do you increase practice your self-awareness?
First, I laugh at myself because I'm – and admit to everyone who knows me and around me is that basically I'm an idiot. And that – you know, I'm a big fan of Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist, who says the opposite of any given truth is not necessarily a falsehood. It's often an even greater truth. And so the truth is that everything that's wrong with anybody, I've pretty much got that going for me. And I've been trying to get good at it, but I'm even failing at that right now.
All right.
So,
go ahead.
So yeah, I'm a mess.
You're not a mess. At least not on the surface.
Well, sure I am.
You're an evolved
yes,
mess.
Exactly.
How about that?
I can fake it.
Yeah, you're
Sorry,
an evolved
mess.
Yeah. All right. Question. That's like the politically correct way to say it. Question two.
Yeah, real nice.
Yeah. Question two. How do you practice honesty with yourself and with others?
Oh boy, that's really hard. I've lived a life of self-delusion because that was my survival thing, you know, imagination, and you know, pretty soon a little guy in a trench coat will come and rescue me, and it'll say it was all a joke. Come on with me, everything's really okay. So I'm probably the most self-deluded person I know, and so I listen to other people, and if anybody makes me feel like arguing, then I want to, you know, ask some questions and see if I can understand the point of view, even though there's this inside thing that really where I really want to be right about something and I really want to shut them down. Instead, I learn by just saying, oh, whoa, I better listen if I'm not sure about how things are.
Great. Question three. How do you use compassion or empathy in your life?
Well, it's a tough one for me because what happens is, I will go to a place where I've experienced some pain that might be similar. And so I'll try to access that so I can understand the other person. But, you know, I have a t-shirt that says, I didn't make this up, but it says, help, I'm talking and I can't shut up. And so pretty soon I'll start talking about myself and it's like, hey, wait a minute, the other person, this is about me. Will you just shut up about your own stuff? So that's how I practice empathy.
Well, you're self-aware, right? So you become self-aware and realize the pattern that you're doing, and you try to shift it back to what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, there's one of my favorite cartoons was called Dave and Darla, and how she practices empathy is she listens, she emotes, she reflects, and that's on a little whiteboard behind her, and then Dave on the other end of the table, David empathizes, and it says, I wait till their lips start moving and then, or stop moving, and then I talk about myself some more. So that's pretty much the way I empathize.
All right. Question. You're not entertaining my questions here. All right. Question. Well, you're entertaining, but question four, I think one of the main things about being authentic is being relatable. So, and relatable to everybody. So how do you relate to the admin all the way to a C-suite? What tricks do you use to do it? Tactics, I guess.
You know Doug Krug, and Doug Krug is the master of never saying anything. He never makes a statement. He just asks a question, and he allows people to get to their own conclusions. And to me, that's the most powerful tool. And so I always start everything with a question, and it's like if I have a meeting with somebody, no matter who it is, I said, if this meeting would turn out ideally for you, and we're looking back on it, it was great for you, it was perfect, looking back on it, what would have happened? What would be the most important thing to happen for you? And then I let that guide me. And, you know, everybody has different outcomes they want, but if I don't have any idea what outcome they want, I'm never going to be able to be in support of them.
Mm-hmm. I like that. All right, last question. Question five, what role does learning play in your life?
Everything, because I have been described as a submarine with a screen door. I tell people I have 6 gigabytes of RAM and no hard drive. That's my head. I can't remember anything, so I'm in a constant state of learning. Besides, learning is one of the only things I think that is fun. And so, you know, whether it's Googling or listening or I just signed up for Steve Martin's Master Comedy course online.
That's so awesome.
How fun is learning, right? That's you know fantastic. We're two wild and crazy guys.
Well, thank you for being authentic or getting authentic. So you have this company for 7 years, though, and did you sell it? Did you shut it down? Because as you said, you know, you're winning all these awards and you're doing things that many ad agencies dream to do. So how do you transition out of that? Like, what do you do to sell it? And then I also kind of wonder at the same time as you're doing this, how is your personal baggage being handled?
Oh, good one. I'm being followed around by porters with the personal baggage. It's like a safari, right? I've got so much personal baggage that people are locked behind me carrying it. I keep handing out tips.
I have heard you're a good tipper, so you got that going for you as well.
Tip nothing but $2 bills.
Which is on your website, so that would make sense.
Yeah. So I actually sold it to a top 10 agency, which is now called Darcy, Macias, Benton, and Bowles. They merged. But at the time, it was called Darcy, McManus, and Macias. They, McManus, John, and Adams, they were merger. McManus, John, and Adams was in Detroit and had all the General Motors business. And Darcy was in St. Louis, had all the Budweiser business. And Macias was in London and owned the world. And so I went in. I sold them the agency, went in as their creative director, and they had been going downhill. And so it was kind of a turnaround thing, which is, you know, for a guy as crazy as I am, oh, look at that, a challenge, let's do that. So sold it to them, and I thought it'd be just simple because there were a whole bunch of people that wanted to work at Fadden as in Cat, but I just couldn't afford them because I couldn't really hang on to any of the money that I made. And I went to Darcy and I said, hey, I've got all the money in the world now. I'm going to, you know, let's go. When do you guys want to start? Here's an offer. And they say, well, are you out of your mind? That agency has a terrible creative reputation. I wouldn't go there for $1 million. I don't care. In fact, I think you're an idiot to go there. So that, I went, whoops, harder than I thought.
Did you ever think about, you just said something there, like people wanted to work for you, but you couldn't afford it. Have you ever in retrospect figured out financially where you went wrong, like where your money was going?
Oh yeah. First of all, I never charged enough. I would always forget to send out the bill. I remember I had a client once who said, and by the way, I tell consulting clients this story still today. There's the VP of marketing of a large consumer products company. And he said, Fadden, if you were my lawyer, I'd be in the electric chair. So I always, the first thing I do is now I say, before we have any kind of association together, there's something that I want you to know about me. And I tell them this story. And they laugh and say, why would you tell me that? And I say, well, I'm really making the point that I'm very, very good at certain things and I'm really bad at others. And if our relationship's going to work, we need to cover the bad ones with somebody other than me.
Yeah. So you figured out how to be self-aware, right? You figured out, like, here are my flaws. I got to get people around me. So then what did you do after this? Because, you know, I think the thing that's really fascinating is this idea of the stand-up comic. So at some point, you know, and this is where I kind of, my question I had a little bit before was about how did your personal baggage impact your business, right? But I feel like every great comic has a lot of personal baggage, right? Or the people who want to be comics. So I'm just kind of curious. It sounds like you kind of carried that baggage with you into that career. When did you start doing that?
Doing
stand-up. Stand-up, sorry.
In an odd kind of a way, I stayed at Darcy for about 3 years, and we actually, it worked. We more than doubled the size in that 3 years, and we, little aside, I developed a creative method. I could only hire the beginners because nobody go to work there. And so the beginners won 29 national awards in their first year. So I figured, oh, I'm onto something. And then, so I left after about 3 years and again, started my own business because I figure if I'm going to have a drink for a boss, it ought to be me. And, So I had a friend at the time who, and I had never considered doing anything like that, but she worked for the public television station there, and they had a program called Night Times. It was like a variety show, and guess what, in the evening. And they asked me to do, would I do, you know, just like something satirical, like, you know, some songs or something like that. And I had played in bands before, and I played a little keyboard. So I sat down at the piano and I wrote a couple satirical songs and did an audition, and they loved it. And so I was on this show for 2 years doing these. Every time there was a news event or they'd run a feature story, then I'd do a satirical song about it, and usually about the Minnesota culture, which was so odd anyway. And so that's where that happened. And so I had a real different kind of a stand-up act because since I was a business guy too, you know, that's a great context to kind of rub things off of. You know, it's like a lot of comics grow up, you know, being a pizza delivery guy or whatever. And, you know, so a lot of the stuff's the same. Well, you know, I hang out with CEOs sometimes, people like that. And there, some of the stuff is so funny because it's so rigid and so forth. And then I turned that into a career in speaking. And comedy is a really good thing to have as a speaker, especially if you have content. You know, those two together is pretty hard to find. And so it made for a very good career in speaking as well.
And so what year is this at this point? Like, where are we at in your trajectory?
Yeah, so this is Fat and Asin Cat for 7 years, Darcy for 3 years. We're talking early 80s. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started doing the satirical songs. And then, you know, I did all kinds of odd things, moved to San Francisco, worked on the Levi's account at Foot Cone and Belding in San Francisco, something I'd always wanted to do. And then went out again. And I always keep going out in my own business because I can't seem to stand working for other people.
Yeah. It sounds like, though, Alan, that, you know, you've had this career that you've been in and out of advertising, doing corporate training gigs, working with all sorts of people. When you're doing these corporate training jobs, what are you doing exactly?
Well, I do something, again, well, surprise, that's quite different. And that is I change the work to fit the people. And it's I'll go back 100 years ago, and what I'm doing today is almost the exact same thing, but with intangible work, because you know, we don't do much manufacturing anymore. Mm-hmm. But in 1910, if you were in an automobile plant and building a car, you were actually assembling the entire car yourself. Mm-hmm. You, James, would start. You'd have a big bunch of parts in front of you, and you start at the beginning, and you'd assemble the car all by yourself, and then you'd finish it. And it would take about 12 and a half hours. And I would do the same thing. I'm working next to you. Right. And the other guy next to me is doing the same thing. 12 and a half hours to assemble a car. Car costs somewhere around $4,000. Well, so Henry Ford had this big idea. That is, we'll standardize the parts and we will have, you know, James, you're really good at engines. Alan, you're really good at transmissions. I think they call them flywheels then. Pete, you're really good at interiors. Joe, you're really good at exteriors. So, James, you do all the engines. Alan, you do all the transmissions. Pete, you do all the interiors. Joe, you do all the exteriors. Within 6 months, the time dropped from 12 and a half hours to assemble a car down to 1 hour and 26 minutes.
Wow.
So the price of the car then dropped from $4,000 to $600. Then Ford had so much money left over that he was able to double his workers' wages. And then once they had money, guess what? They could buy a car. So everybody started buying cars. And then they realized something. Hey, wait a minute. We don't have any roads. Where are these cars going to go? So they started building roads. And then they built the roads. And they said, hey, wait a minute. We don't have any hotels on these roads. We don't have any restaurants. And so the whole economy went nuts from like 1912 up all the way up to the crash of 29.
So what is
prosperity, including war.
But I'm trying to go, what the hell does it have to do with you as a corporate trainer?
Absolutely nothing. So think about this. Think about the stuff that we take as gospel, because just because it's been around, it's like, hey, James, nice idea. Why don't you run with it? Well, you know what? If you were brilliant enough to come up with that idea, you're probably the last person who should run with it. In other words, we are not these perfectly balanced machines of beings that do all the parts of the work equally well. So today, and you can really, it's really transparent in software, but it's basically, you go from the idea to the plan, you know, which idea are we going to run with? We make a plan to implement the idea, then we say everything that's going to go wrong. We present all the warnings, what are the pitfalls? And then hopefully we solve those problems, and then we go ahead and we implement it and integrate it into the system. What I've described there is actually my method. It's called the hoodoo method. It's who does what and who does what when. And we've got it all wrong right now. If you go to a meeting someplace and you have an idea, what happens? Bang, 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 bang. You can't do that. You know, you'll never get that done here. You can't do it. It's illegal in 18 states. Oh, we tried that once before. So everybody's naysaying ideas. And so we keep their natural naysayers and their natural idea people, keep them apart. And then go to the naysayers once you pick the idea and then say everything that can go wrong. Okay, it's illegal in 18 states. You can't do that. And instead of fighting with them or instead of them killing the idea, no, can't kill the idea. Thanks very much. See you later. So then you take that problem back to the people who thought up the idea in the first place. And you say, okay, it's illegal in 18 states. We're trying for a 50-state launch. What are we going to do? And somebody says, well, wait a minute. Doesn't that mean it's legal in 32 states? And, you know, some people will say, doesn't that mean it's legal in 55 states? But, you know, you get the idea. Mm-hmm. It's legal in these other states. Why don't we launch in those states? Okay, and then laws change, so we'll track everything we do, and then we'll go into the 18 states, and we'll lobby to change the laws. Now we got a 50-state rollout. So, and you do that in, like, record short time because you eliminate all the things that don't work, all the arguing, all the bickering, the naysaying, the sandbagging, and so forth. So
how did you get to that? Like, throughout this whole thing, I keep going back to this. And I've tried to ask a couple different ways, but you don't have the Ward and Beaver Cleaver upbringing, and so I'm trying to understand when did you have your coming to Jesus moment, and you know, it can't be I'm sure it's a culmination of books, but you know, because was there a moment where you said, you know what, I can't handle this, and I need to kind of reprogram myself, because you know, we're all creatures of repeated habits, and we're all creatures of what learnings we had until we deprogram those.
Yeah, really, really a great point. I've actually done it several times. I've had those moments, and one of them, one transformative one, is one we talked about, which is, you know, basically I grew up not fitting in. Well, God. You know, anybody who's listening to this knows that they didn't either. For the most part, none of us quite fit in. But I didn't fit in so many ways. And when I found the advertising career, wow, here's a place where you can think of ideas. And I can't believe they pay me for this. So that was like a big formative moment. And so that gave me a lot of comfort and gave me some confidence. Well, now, the interesting thing was that we have these, I think St. John of the Cross talked about dark night of soul. We have dark nights of soul, and one of them that I had was I was 27 years old, and I swept the Minnesota Award Show. My little agency, which means mostly me, all the people who wouldn't hire me, I aced them out. I won best gold awards for like 13 best ads, best campaign, and best of show, and shut out everybody else. And everybody came up to me, and I was, you know, this is going to be the greatest moment of my life. It was the worst moment of my life. One after one, these people came up and shook my hand and said, "Hey, congratulations. We're going to get you, you asshole." You know, it was like, whoa, what is this? And so, you know, there's only one thing worse than not getting what you want, and that's getting what you
want. So, and, go ahead.
So I spent the better part of a year saying, what am I doing? What is this? You know, that wasn't worth it. And so I was searching for things. And at the time, you know, everybody's protesting the war and so forth. And all my values were flying out the window. And then I found another book. These books are really good things. Be Here Now by Ram Dass. Mm-hmm. And he said, here's the paradox. We can't have it all until we are willing to give it all up. Mm-hmm. And so I stayed home from work for a few days, and all I did was wrestle with that paradox. And finally, on a Thursday morning about 10 o'clock, I was starting to laugh. And then I laughed for about, I laughed for about 5 hours straight. I couldn't stop laughing. It was so funny. And cause I finally got the paradox. Mm. And, well, exactly what it said. The only way to have it all is to give it all up. But I reinterpreted it cause I couldn't get it in his terms. And I went out the door and I walked down my street. And I said to myself, what's funny is I own all these houses. These are all mine, right? Because I can enjoy them, and I've given up kind of the concept of owning my own house, even though I still owned it. And you know, it's like having and have not. Somewhere above, those two things come together, and there's this whole having thing. You know, it's like being and doing come together, and it's all being. Mm-hmm. That in fact, that's the title of his book, Be Here Now. Being and doing come together on a high level. It's all about being. Here and there come together, and it's all here. There's no distance. So it's like, this is my little kingdom here. You know, I was back to being a kid again. You know, the great book, Dandelion Wine, Ray Bradbury, a kid wakes up every morning and he directs like an orchestra, all the lights in the neighborhood coming on. And it's because it's his domain. And so his realm. And that just changed my attitude towards things. And since then, I've never really worried about what I didn't have anymore.
So, you know, looking over, like perusing your bio, you know, you've done and worked with a whole bunch of large companies, Fortune 500 companies. You've done stuff and met like Paul McCartney, Bill Murray, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing these things, like, is it because of these books you were able to do these things? Because it allowed you to detach from your past and to say that I deserve to be here. I should belong in these conversations at the table with these people. I don't know if there was a question in that or not, but.
No, I hear you, because and that too is a bit gradual, because I had such low self-esteem. It's like, oh, I don't belong. Mm-hmm. Forget it. I'm an idiot. I'm just, I'll have nothing to say. And so I don't know if you remember the Smothers Brothers.
Yes.
Tommy Smothers. Well, I did a Dental Society advertising campaign that actually got syndicated and went around the country. And it was ignore your teeth and they'll go away. And so I had Tommy Smothers play a tooth fairy that refused to put quarters under the pillows. In fact, he's going to start stealing your pillows because everybody is losing their teeth. Because they weren't flossing and all that. So I spent a few days with the Smothers Brothers doing these commercials, and I realized, whoa, it's just, I don't know, I was cowed at first, and then they're just people too. Mm-hmm.
You talk about the books that helped you transform, but clearly, mm-hmm. as you said, right, you read these books and made you realize that we all put our pants on the same way, people just want to be listened to, and that actually fed you the confidence to feel like you belong in the room with these different people. And that's a powerful pill to swallow, so to speak.
Well, and especially the journey, because the journey began with my father was extremely abusive, so abusive that I was completely shut down. So, I mean, I was, a complete geek. And so that's where I started. And
that's so unfair to say that about yourself, though, Alan. Because, no, I mean, I'm being honest. Like, you can't say you were a complete geek. You were a kid that was mentally and physically abused to the point of fear. Like, the fear of someone saying your name puts you in, like, that is an excuse, my friends. So fucked up.
Yeah. In fact, because I've made my whole life, I adore the whole topic of creativity. In fact, I even wrote a book about it, making a unifying theory of creativity. I love creativity so much. But my creativity started with always having to be quick of mind to search for an escape route. And it could be an escape route or an alternative answer to a question, anything. It's my mind. If somebody's starting to say something and it's a threat, my mind is so quick. Mm. I don't shut down in a threat. I'm like the Flash. I'm at 88 points in the room at once.
You're trying to figure out how to diffuse the situation, change the topic, redirect.
Right. And it was so natural that when I was 4 years old, I don't tell many people this story, but my father, so he'd always scream at me. And so one day he asked me a riddle, and I went, oh, God, this is not going to end well. And he says, Alan, if I had five apples, I'm sorry. He said, Alan, if you had five apples, meaning me, and he ate one, how many apples would I have left? And I said, three. And he looks at me and he says, no, let me ask you again. He asked me the same question, five apples, he eats one of mine. How many do I have left? I said, three. And he said, no. And he starts raising his voice and he starts yelling and he tells me again. And this time he's yelling it at me. And finally, my mother intervenes and because I keep answering three. And he says, no, it's four. And my mother intervenes and says, at least ask him why it's three. And I said, because I'd want one too.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, I just about break into tears when this happens. All of a sudden, my father looked at me with respect for the first and perhaps only time ever. He says, very clever young boy, something like that.
Like, what do you do now? Like, what's, if I was to call you and say, hey, Alan, I want you to do X for me, what would you do professionally?
Yeah. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, I had to clarify that.
So the kind of calls that I get are the kinds of things that people want. One is, hey, Alan, will you speak at our meeting? Our people need shaking up. Or will you come in and train us in your hoodoo method because we're stuck? I had a big company who said, we're trying to come up with a new product and we can't even get the R&D people to commit to a schedule. Something's wrong here. Will you come in and teach us your stuff and see if you can get us unclogged? I'm a great unclogger. But it usually involves, so it usually means, set a date, get on an airplane, meet us in Orlando. We've got the team down there for a couple of days and spend a morning with us. And so that team that couldn't get people to commit to a plan, it turns out that the R&D people were full of people like me. We call ourselves shakers. You know, we like to shake things up. Movers and shakers were the shakers. And it was an affront to them because the company wanted them to do a parody product, a Me Too product to disrupt their competitors' test market. And they said, we don't do that. We only do superior products. And it was like, we can't do that. It's against our religion. And so we went through the process and they had an aha at the end that you can also play, you can win a game by playing defense as well as you can playing offense. Sure. And so, it's stuff like that. The worse the problem, the better I like it.
So the last topic I kind of want to touch base on is that you've written a string of books that have, for the most part, unique names to go with them, Book Itch, is Half the World Crazy. This one's The Most Normal, Innovation on Demand. The other one is another boring, derivative piece of crap business book.
Yes.
So I'm in the process of writing my first book, and I'm curious about where your innovation comes from, where motivation comes from to write these books.
Oh, great one. And congratulations and condolences at the same time.
Yeah, talk to me when it's done.
Yeah.
having written a dissertation and, you know, a 200-page basically book that four people read that I had no desire to write cannot be much worse than that.
Or, yes, it can. Because,
thank you.
The average book sells 100 copies. And if you look at the long tail kind of a thing, you know, the statistics, because the number one book sold 1.3 million this year. And so that takes care of a lot of, so the average, you know, is maybe 100, but there are thousands of books that sell only one copy. And it's the guy who prints it at Lulu and buys his own first copy. And, okay, you're done. So, you know, thanks to new technology, we don't have to have a garage full of books.
Yeah. So back, what was your motivation to write these?
Oh, yeah. When the first book, that's why it has the greatest title, was published in 92 after 14 years. It took me 14 years to write it. And I discovered the unifying theory of creativity. And so I thought, geez, I could be an author. I can be somebody. And so I just kept working at it and letting it alone and not doing it. And then finally got it out. But I had a message and you know, it actually says this in the book, itch, I think. I wrote that book for a publisher who wanted to convince people to write a book. And one of the lines in there is that no CEO ever spent 4 hours reading your business card on an airplane.
What kind of dog do you have?
He's sorry about that. He's part Lhasa and part terrorist.
Terrier, got it.
Yeah, he's a little cute Benji dog. He's 17 years old. He's nothing but evil. He looks like a puppy and a teddy bear all rolled into one. Oh, he's so cute. And then he goes, rawr, rawr, and bites you.
He's just cranky.
Just cranky, yeah, exactly. So to me, a book is it's like a ticket to get into a lot of places with people emotionally, mentally, and so forth. Now, it's been tarnished a lot because, you know, it used to be that, you know, you're a published author. That means Random House bought your book. Now, you know, anybody can have a book who can pay for it.
Yeah.
So it's not what it was, but it's still the discipline of doing so and the things that you do to get a book done. And, you know, writing, it's the last thing you should do. You know, do all the marketing first. What's your hook? And this is some people don't want. All of that makes your business boom because you're down to the right message, the whole discipline of the process. You know, it's an excuse to be doing what you ought to do in the first place for your business.
So I guess it goes back to my motivation to write these books. Was these all for you to generate new streams of business?
Well, the first one was to express myself. I wanted this available to other people. What's my legacy? You know, what am I going to pass on to people? I want people to pay attention to me. You know, my mantra is three words: look at me. So I want people to look at me. You know, now contrast that with the kid in kindergarten: don't look at me, don't ever look at me. Yeah, look at me, look at me. So now I'm speaking in front of you know, audiences up to 2,000 and things like that. So a lot of it is just to get it out there. It's like winning awards in advertising. I want to be at the top of my field. I want people to know what I do. And it's just a great vehicle to do that.
Awesome. So you've been super awesome your time. Final question, and then I'll let you vominos. How do you define happiness?
I define it as the only real state of consciousness. And when I am not in that state, then I'm off the path. Because they're even, I mean, in the middle of trauma, there's a certain kind of happiness you can have, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. The happiness could be confidence. It could be love. It could be closeness with other people. It's, we're going to get through this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of all the old saying, it's not what happens to you, it's what you do with it.
Yeah, it's your response.
Yeah, so to me, it's the only real state of consciousness and I believe, kind of back to the be here now, that when you are in that state of being here now, that you are in a place where there is only happiness by definition. It can't be any other way.
That's awesome. Well, Alan, thank you for your time and energy and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Thank you, James. You know, you've made me very happy.
I only get that like once a month, so I'm pretty happy I got that response.